Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the Anlaw Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Laufer, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The Anlaw Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NucleCast. Of course, I'm your host, Adam Lowther, and today we are talking to Mohammed Faisal, who is currently completing his PhD in Australia, but he previously served as a fellow at the Institute for Strategic Studies in Islamabad, and he's been at the Stimson Center, and he's been in, at the Center for Nonproliferation Studies in Monterey. So he's been around this community for a while, and we wanted to talk. One of the topics we've never actually talked about is Pakistan's nuclear program, and that, of course, is something that Mohammed knows quite a bit about, and so we thought we'd have him on the show to have that discussion. So welcome to NucleCast.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure, and thank you for the opportunity.
So, could you start off by giving us a brief history of Pakistan's nuclear program? How did it come about? What was the felt need for going nuclear? And just sort of fill us in for those who might not know this history and rationale.
Thank you. So to start off, Pakistan's idea of pursuing a nuclear weapons program, so there are two parts, if I can divide it in that sort. First is Pakistan's idea of thinking about having a nuclear option. That was rooted in earlier from the 1960s, when Pakistan and India, they went to war over Kashmir in 1965. And there at that time, there was this thinking that India might be pursuing the nuclear option, so let's keep our options open. And in 1967, when the time came for the global nuclear non-proliferation treaty, Pakistan and India did not sign it. It was initially these two countries and among few others that was the holdouts. They didn't join it. So when India didn't join it, Pakistani decision makers and policymakers were like, we also need to keep our options open. Let's not sign it right now. And at that time, Pakistan was engaging with the United States. And they were getting a civil nuclear technology through the Atoms for Peace program, and Pakistan has got a research reactor from the Canadians. That was to set up a little bit of human capital, trying to get them trained in the US and Canada, trying to see what they can learn in the nuclear field. That was that. But the 1971 war changed the security calculus for the Pakistani decision makers. The loss of East Pakistan that became Bangladesh as a result of that war, that accelerated the Pakistani thinking about pursuing and having a nuclear option in terms of a weapons program. The war ended in December 1971. Just 40 days later, about in January 1972, the then Prime Minister convened the meeting with the nuclear scientists and the military hierarchy, and he gave them the order to start laying down the foundations for a nuclear weapons program. That started first with recruitment of people, getting Pakistanis who are in the nuclear field, the labs, to get them to the, having them in place as a project, trying to get the fundings in place, and also see what options, what nuclear pathways could Pakistan take going forward. So there was a calculus that was security driven and also the need to have a balance and deterrence with India. And since then, from 1972 onwards, Pakistan continued on the path. The accelerated push then, the next push that came was India's nuclear test in 1974, which India branded as a peaceful nuclear explosion. But nuclear explosion could anything but be peaceful. That was there. From that moment onwards, Pakistani development initiative, it got accelerated. Pakistan's what Pakistani policymakers did was they tried to have two competing labs, one working on the plutonium pathway, the other working on the uranium centrifuge pathway. They gave them resources to pursue both. It was a shot at, you could end up with either a plutonium bomb or you could end up a uranium bomb, centrifuge-based bomb. So there were two labs not interconnected. And the first one, the Pakistan Atomic Energy Commission, was in place from 1956. And that was also engaging in international cooperation prior. So it had the experience and the international partnerships as well. It was Pakistan's lead agency dealing with the International Atomic Energy Agency. So it had the human capital as well, the manpower as well needed to, that was already working on the nuclear issues, a nuclear weapon, not the weapons at that time, but nuclear physics issues. The other one was at that time, Project 706, which was later known as KRL, the Khan Research Laboratories. That was started by Pakistani meteorologist Abdul Qadir Khan, who got later on entangled into the nuclear proliferation scandal. But in 1970s, at that time, he was working at the Uranico lab in Europe, Holland. And from there on, he moved to Pakistan. Some say also there is a written documented history that he got designs from there, and then Pakistanis pursued their designs. So there was that. That was a centrifuge pathway for the uranium-based bomb. From 1971 onwards till 1984, Pakistanis tried to have a workable nuclear warhead or a bomb, what they call it. And in 1984, it is documented that Pakistanis carried out the first coal test. And the results of the coal test actually gave them the confidence that they were on a successful pathway, that they could end up there. And from there onwards till 1998, Pakistan was a country with a bomb in a basement. Pakistan did not hot test, but we saw the evidence of Pakistan signaling that it had the capability to demonstrate a nuclear weapon if it needed to from 1990 onwards, when there was the first India-Pakistan crisis. And the 1990 crisis, there was signaling. So there is then. And in 1998, interesting, coincidentally, next week will be about 26 years that the South Asia went nuclear, in the sense that Pakistan demonstrated its nuclear capability. On 11th May 1998, India tested nuclear weapons, and it repeated with a couple of more on the 13th May. So there was a pressure that came on Pakistan to test. Pakistani political leadership came under pressure. There was hectic diplomacy by the US, by the EU, to dissuade Pakistan from exercising the nuclear option and demonstrating its capability. But the Pakistani political and the military leadership, because there is an ongoing rivalry with India, so they needed to equalize there, and they decided to test. On 28th May, Pakistan went ahead and conducted 5 nuclear tests in Chagi, Balochistan, and that was Pakistan coming out as a nuclear weapon state. That was one phase of the nuclear weapons program history. And from 1998 onwards, the focus then was on the consolidation of the nuclear enterprise. Also, when it was pre-1998, the Pakistani decision makers' direction, and also kind of what I call it, oversight of the nuclear enterprise, it was patchy, in a sense, it was loose, in the sense that it was a covert nuclear weapons program, so the government couldn't really do much on the legal front about it. So after the demonstration of the nuclear weapon capability in May 1998, Pakistanis went about consolidating and implementing a rigid oversight program. And from then onwards, what we see is a thoughtful development of missile delivery systems, a thoughtful development of nuclear warheads and the weapons, to cater to the operational needs of Pakistan's military as it seeks to deter India. That was there. And now, 25 years later, what we see is Pakistan not just demonstrating a workable nuclear option, but also having the nuclear warheads that can be delivered from the ranges of 60 to 70 kilometers as a tactical nuclear weapon to up to 2750. And in the process, Pakistan has medium-range missiles, cruise missiles. Pakistan has demonstrated MIRV technology option. So there is a lot of this suite of capabilities that Pakistan is developing. And they have the standoff range from the air-launched missiles. They have ground-launched missiles. And now they have also tested a naval variant of a cruise missile to be placed on the submarines and the warships on the conventionally powered so far. Pakistan doesn't have a nuclear-powered submarine. So there is that. There is a nascent second strike capability, but the idea is to get to that. But there is a resource constraint and all that. So that's broad and long and short of Pakistan's nuclear history there.
So as you think about where Pakistan is now, and I think back to my trips to India in talking to the Indians, I expected, as I talked to them about their security concerns, I expected them to bring up Pakistan as a security concern, but they never really did. They always brought up China as a security concern, that's the big threat. So from your perspective, from the perspective of Pakistan, does Pakistan still see India as the threat that it saw India as, you know, say the 1970s, the 1980s, the 1990s, the cold start period? Or is that a diminishing threat, an expanding threat? Where do we stand in terms of this? And then the second part of that question is, where does Pakistan go in the future? What's it designing its nuclear force to do?
Good questions. The first one on the Pakistani threat perception. Pakistani threat perception is primarily right now even India-centric. There is a freeze in the India-Pakistan relationship. That's what determines Pakistan's threat perception there. Yes, there could be the levels of the threat that varies over time. That is there. And also, what Pakistan has seen in the current Indian leadership is its willingness to use force against Pakistan. And what we saw in 2019, an exchange of air attacks, air strikes on both sides. First, India did it, then Pakistan did it. Pakistan was able to down an Indian jet, and a pilot landed on the Pakistani side. Pakistan captured that, and that blew out into mini crisis. Now, if you think about it, it could have been a Pakistani jet that could have downed. It could have been a Pakistani pilot that would have landed on that side. So the dynamics of crisis would have been different, but it was pure luck there. But given that India has shown the inclination to use force and resort to will use of force, so in the Pakistani decision makers' calculus, the threat perception from India hasn't gone down. Yes,
yeah.
The crisis with India, the threat from India is not of a threat that a war will be waged. That isn't there now. That has receded. There is that. But the political and the threat of you that India could use force in some event, in a contingency, that is still there. So that factor into Pakistani decision making right now. And more than that, from the Pakistani decision makers' point of view, what they saw was India's willingness to change the status quo. And by that I mean, when in August 2019, India went ahead and unilaterally changed the status of Indian-administered Kashmir. Now, that's a disputed territory even recognized by the United Nations. And both sides had committed after the 1971 war to maintain the status quo, pending the final resolution of the dispute. Now, when India went ahead and changed the status quo on its side, that now also signals to Pakistani side that, well, the power gap, asymmetry between India and Pakistan is such that India disregards the ground facts and even its commitments made to the United Nations. So there is, in the Pakistani threat perception, that also plays a role. Third factor there is, yes, India's relationship with China has deteriorated. For now, China takes a precedence over Pakistan in India's threat perception. Yes, there is there. But has India given up the option to use force against Pakistan? India hasn't signaled that clearly. And for past 5 years, at least, from August 2019 onwards, Pakistan-India relationship is in a virtual freeze. There is no direct dialogue. While there is tense calm on the borders and the line of control in Kashmir, there is a ceasefire that's holding up. But more than that, there is nothing they are talking. They are not trading. The visas are not being given to even the sportsmen from the both sides. So there's that.
Yeah.
On your second question about what is Pakistan's long-term thinking about its nuclear force and modernization, Pakistan's long-term thinking is to maintain and sustain the current force posture, maintain and sustain its current investments into the nuclear force and the broader missile program and also the civil nuclear program. And over the long term, that is 25 to 30 years, being able to field a credible second strike capability.
Yeah. So so no pursuit of, you know, take North Korea, for example, that has pursued a intercontinental ballistic missile program. They want a very clear nuclear triad. That's not really something that Pakistan is particularly interested in. They're focused more regionally.
So far,
India.
So far, yes. Pakistan's third perception is India focused. And when I said that Pakistan wants to field a credible second strike capability, that brings in the Tarayd. They have the ground launch option. They have the air launched option for F-16s and the J-10s if they can be used in that one. They have a nascent second strike capability. So the Tarayd option is there. That's what they're pursuing. But on the long-range intercontinental ballistic missile, Pakistan, for that, Pakistan also needs to have very resourceful space program. Pakistan doesn't have that. Pakistan has a resource constraint there. And the last long-range Pakistan missile that Pakistan tested was, or field demonstrated, it has a range of 2750 kilometers, 2750. That was Shaheen 3. That's a medium range. And it was first tested in March 2015. And we are talking in May 2024. It's been 9 years. Pakistanis haven't fielded a new missile beyond that range. A military argument can be made that while India has ICBMs, so why not we should have ICBMs? The Pakistanis should have ICBMs. It's not an open-ended race for a missile for a range missile. And when you are deterring the next door neighbor, why do you need 5,000 or 7,000 kilometer long range missile?
Yeah, it's a fair point. It makes sense. Now it's that time in the show where we have to take a quick break. So when we come back, I'd like for you to talk about the role the United States is playing with Pakistan. Now that relationship has gone up and down, and it's where are we now, and is the U.S. in any way influencing Pakistan's nuclear program? You're listening to NucleCast, and we'll be right back.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the Ann Law Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
And we're back, and we're talking to Mohammed Faisal, and we're talking about the Pakistani nuclear program. So, Mohammed, I gave you a question before the break, and I'll turn it back over to you.
No, thank you. On the U.S. role in the Pakistani nuclear program, the U.S. role can be categorized into two types of roles. The first is U.S. has played an active role in the Pakistani nuclear program in the sense that from the get-go, U.S. had concerns about Pakistan's pursuit of nuclear weapons program. So there was that when Pakistan went down this path in late 1970s, U.S. imposed sanctions. U.S. tried to persuade Pakistan to not go down this path. Even during the Zulfikar Ali Bhutto era, that was from 1971 to 77. There, it's part of the public record and economic literature now that U.S. Tried to engage Pakistani political and military leadership about a package on the defense modernization that would persuade Pakistan that what it wants from its nuclear capability to do, it can get that from modernization of its conventional forces. Pakistanis were seeking a nuclear umbrella. The US was unwilling to commit to that. So there is that factor. But for the Pakistanis, the calculus changed, and for the US as well, when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan. Gradually, over time, Pakistan, US, and the Saudis, they were cooperating very closely and pushing back against the Soviet forces, Red Army in Afghanistan. So, in a way, some say that the US turned a blind eye or looked the other way as Pakistan pursued its nuclear weapons program. And there is a letter of President Ziaul-Haq, and they exchanged letters with President Reagan that, oh, I will not embarrass you. So that was taken as Pakistan is saying that, oh, we will not test a nuclear weapon. That yeah. We won't make it that much an issue. So during '80s, the Pakistanis got that much space to pursue the nuclear weapons program. And then as the Soviet Union departed and the relationship took a turn, as it is taking a turn right now, even the US again imposed sanctions. So interestingly, during the Reagan era and the first Bush administration, Bush senior administration, so the Secretary of State was to certify every year to the Congress that Pakistan can receive its security and economic assistance. And he certifies that Pakistan is not pursuing a nuclear weapons program. Until 1989, till the time that the Soviet Union was in Afghanistan, the Secretary of State would every year certify that. After the Soviet forces had departed, Secretary of State suddenly saw that, hey, I can't certify anymore. So the sanctions, Pressler and others kicked in. In that time, US role also came up in the crisis management between India and Pakistan. The shuttle diplomacy, when both Pakistan and Indian forces were mobilized and sent to borders in the name of exercises, that created a threat of risk of war. So at that time, the U.S. Interagency delegations would fly into both in New Delhi and Islamabad, engage with both the political leaderships on both sides, and try to de-escalate the crisis, find a way out. So that's the other role of the U.S., which the U.S. has continued to play so till now, even as late as the February 2019 crisis. After Pakistan went nuclear, and when India also went nuclear in 1998, the U.S. engaged both India and Pakistan on in a dialogue or direct bilateral India-U.S. and U.S.-Pakistan dialogue over management of the nuclear enterprise, what Pakistanis and Indians thought about the doctrines, in Pakistani case, how to keep the nuclear weapons safe and secure. So that was a running concern there. And the question that you asked earlier about on the long-range program and the missile development, that conversation with Pakistan has been going on. That's a part of U.S.-Pakistan bilateral talks as well. So again, for the Pakistan, the fortunes changed after the 9/11. Yeah. Because as the U.S. forces, they moved to launch Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan, the U.S.-Pakistan relationship saw a strategic shift. And it focused more on the counterterrorism and cooperation of Taliban and all that issues. So Pakistan had that space to pursue its nuclear weapons development, missile development, and it also engaged with the U.S. on the nuclear security best practices. So there has been that during the Bush administration, the Bush junior administrations, and that has continued till later in the Obama administration as well. And non-proliferation and strategic stability dialogue forms an important subset of strategic dialogue between U.S. and Pakistan.
So for many of our listeners, they may not be familiar with the command and control approach that Pakistan has to its nuclear weapons. Could you sort of explain that for our listeners?
So the Pakistani command and control, it's bifurcated into two. There is an organization that Pakistan set up after the 1998 tests that did not exist in the military in the form of a full-fledged organization that was known as Strategic Plans Division. Think of it as Pakistan's nuclear NNSA.
Right.
Under the Department of Energy.
Right.
It has it is the executive agent of the Pakistani government and the military also to exercise administrative control and ensure security of the whole nuclear enterprise. So there's that. The political decision to use the nuclear weapons and on that front is to be taken by the National Command Authority.
So it's not a specific decision made by the president.
So in the Pakistani system, it's a parliamentary system like the Australia or the UK. So the executive authority flows from the office of the prime minister.
Okay.
So the president is just a symbolic in the sense that like king of England these days or the previous queen.
Does the head of government make those decisions?
Head of government. The executive authority flows from the head of government.
Okay.
And we have seen the Pakistani, this SPD taking the successive heads of government to the nuclear weapons storage sites, even giving them tours. We have seen that evidence in the public domain. So there is that. And beyond that, the missile forces, they are... So Pakistan doesn't have a single strategic force like India has. It just have one unified strategic force. Pakistan has separate strategic forces, commands of Army, Navy, and Air Force. Army having the ground-launched missiles, Air Force having the air-launched ones, and Navy having the sea-based missiles. But the warheads are in the custody of Strategic Plans Division, which ensures their security. And those are only to be released after a decision has been made by the National Command Authority, in which both the civilians and the military are represented. And interestingly, earlier, prior to nuclearization in 1998, Pakistan has this forum called Joint Chiefs of Staff Committee. And by the Pakistani tradition was the chairmanship would rotate between the heads of Army, Navy, and Air Force. But from post-1998, what we see is a designated four-star general from the Pakistan Army being placed as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, rather than it being rotated. And under him is placed a Strategic Plans Division and the Strategic Forces. And on the nuclear matters, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, he liaisons with the Prime Minister's office.
I gotcha.
Yeah. So that is the kind of way. Because the Strategic Plans Division is primarily a military-led organization, it is headed by a serving three-star general. So in a sense, the military's influence in the decision-making is much higher, at the much higher pedestal than the civilians in that way. But when it comes to the political decision-making on the use of, when will be the nuclear weapon used, employed, or to go down that path, that would have to be taken in consultation with the political leadership.
Right. Okay. Now, unfortunately, we're running out of time, so I don't want to forget to bring out Bob the Genie. Mm-hmm. And if I rub my magic lamp and Bob grants you three wishes related to the topics we've been discussing.
No.
So if you can't wish for wealth or fame or any of that, but you can make wishes related to our topics. So Muhammad, what is your first wish?
No, my first wish, interesting. To see that there is a stable India-Pakistan nuclear relationship where both actually have nuclear risk reduction, more confidence building measures. And have more regular nuclear dialogue. That's there used to be, but it's suspended. There is need for a nuclear dialogue there.
Yeah, that's a good first wish. Okay, how about wish number two?
I sometimes imagine that maybe there is time for Chinese, Americans, Indians, and Pakistanis to sit together in a room.
Yeah,
and discuss the regional security. What we see is the versions of Pakistanis and Chinese discussing, Indians and Americans discussing, or in some faraway settings, Indians, Pakistanis, and Americans discussing in track twos. What we don't regularly see is Indians, Pakistanis, Chinese, and Americans getting together and discussing regional security, getting all the actors in the room to discuss.
Yeah, that's a tough one these days.
Yeah, sure. That's a tough one. That's a tough one.
Okay, so we're down to your final wish. So, Muhammad, mm-hmm. wish number three.
Wish number three. Maybe to write an article on how Chinese perceive both India and Pakistan's nuclear weapons program, if they all decide to talk.
Yeah, that would be interesting to see how they think, because for the Americans right now, it's a challenge to, you know, sort of South Asia for us is a very difficult place because it's, you know, it's not Europe, it's not our traditional allies in Asia. It's a very cagey area for us to try to, you know, to have influence and to, you know, keep the Chinese out, because that's one of the things we definitely keep the Russians and the Chinese out. So it's a difficult area these days.
Yeah, it's a difficult area. And that's why I think that engaging with Chinese is important. But it's also that it's, as you say, it's difficult. So, but as engagement is the only way.
Yeah.
Engagement should never stop.
So if you were to give a quick elevator speech to our listeners, explaining what you want them to know about Pakistan's nuclear program or ambitions that they remember 6 months or 12 months from now, what would be that thing you would tell them?
I would say that Pakistan's nuclear ambitions, as we often see here, comparisons with North Korea, that aren't there. Pakistan has been managing the nuclear capability for 26 years now, the nuclear weapons and the missile forces and all that. And it has consistently shown that its ambitions are only India-focused, India, and its program is India-driven. That's a specific theory, security threat that they have. It takes, because there are two factors related to that. A, it's also a source of national pride for the reasons of prestige as well. So,
right.
And there is a running, some even say that, and late Michael Crapon used to say that he was the founder of co-founder of the Stimson Center, that while Pakistanis disagree about a lot, but they agree on two things, on the need to have nuclear weapons and the cricket.
Yeah.
That's Pakistani baseball. So, so in that sense, the political ownership by the political parties and the public is there.
So, yeah.
And there is that. So in a sense, it's very different from North Korea. It's very different from Iran.
Yeah.
And going forward, Pakistan could be one of the few countries in the world, or maybe there could be Japan we can talk about. If Iran develops and demonstrates a nuclear weapon, then that would make Pakistan being neighbor with three nuclear powers, India, China, and Iran.
Mm. Yeah. That's a good point. All right.
So it's a tough neighborhood there.
Yeah. Muhammad Faisal, thanks for joining us on NucleCast.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Great discussion.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
And thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us. And we will see you on the next episode.
This has been a production of the Anwar Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Grunthal. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.